This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 17th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 341 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Marcus Hippie.
On today's show, we'll be hearing from a novelist, Adam Philwell, and a gallerist, Taya Lee Boz, about how they've combined art and publishing in a new work, Radio Paper, and how far you can push the reach of both disciplines while staying on the same page.
We'll also be talking to the Sisters Grimm, aka composers and theatre producers Ella Spira and Pietra Mello Pittman, about their Grammy-nominated successes on stage and off.
And we'll remember the life of David Bowie, who died this week, with an archive interview with the man who helped define his image, photographer Mick Rock.
That is all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll spin a Bowie track too, of course. How could we not? Right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Marcus. It's the beginning of a new year, and already the Monocle Weekly is falling to pieces before our eyes. But I kind of like it. I like sharing a bit of studio time with Marcus Hippie. It's a rare occurrence.
Exactly. We haven't done this even nearly enough. Who knows? Maybe this is the beginning of something new and great.
I like it. I thought if I was sharing a studio with a Finn, you'd have it cranked down. You'd have it sort of at minus two. You're wearing some fine radio knitwear. But thank God you've cranked it up. It's actually warm in the Monocle Weekly studio for once. I love it.
I know. I thought we needed something special for this occasion.
It sort of feels Christmassy. I feel like I should be roasting chestnuts on an open fire or something similar.
It's true. I almost could have worn my Christmas jumper for this event as well.
You could have done. And in London at the moment, we were experiencing some sort of Finnish winter weather, right? Finally, it's gotten cold. All the buds, all the daffodils, all the things that were peeping out and kind of trying to be spring-like have become flaccid, let's just say.
It's quite amusing, actually. I'm from Finland. I'm used to minus 25 degree weather, and here I'm in London moaning about how cold it is all the time, non-stop.
Exactly. Why don't we stay in here for the next hour, crank up the heating, get some nice guests in. First of all, we're sorry to say it's Henry Rees Sheridan with the news look ahead. Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop. But how am I doing now? How am I doing now? Everything is all right. And as so often, you are here once again to give us an idea of what's coming up during the following 7 days or so.
I am, Marcus. It's a week of heated debate, friction and competition.
You make it sound quite exciting.
Well, just wait till you hear what I've got in store.
It's like an orgy of news.
I think it's Knapp's metaphor, frankly.
Yeah.
An orgy. I'm going to write, yeah, we can run with that.
And what do we start that orgy with?
Let's start it
Impress
off
us.
With, on Monday the 18th of January, the German Christian Social Union political party will hold a closed meeting of its parliamentary party in Bavaria. The CSU is a sister party of Merkel's party, the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, and Merkel and the finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble are both expected to attend. Now, I anticipate...
Henry.
Rob, are you feeling it?
Yeah, I'm really feeling it. That's really... I'm glad I got lubed up for that one.
I mean, listen... Let me give some more juicy details, okay?
You need to work on me, Marcus, a bit harder.
I think that this is going to be a heated debate in the Bavarian parliament, precisely. Obviously, there's a massive tension within the German right at the moment over the issue of migration. Yeah. It's been heated by the New Year's Eve assault. How are you feeling now, guys? Is this warming up? The New Year's Eve assault.
Stop saying that. It's a come on. You can't keep on saying New Year's Eve assault in the hope that it's going to get
us. We should maybe even probably re-record that. No, it's fine. Producer shaking his head. There are sceptics, a contingent of sceptics within the right-wing bloc, which are calling for they're going to make a formal call on full border controls in Germany and the barring of almost all refugees arriving at Germany's borders. There are many who have been sceptical of Merkel's open doors approach from the beginning.
Exactly.
So it's going to be interesting.
Right.
Cool. Any thoughts, feelings? Should I just move straight on?
I don't know. I'm kind of raring to go. I'm feeling a bit hot and flustered now.
Okay.
It's a strike while the iron's
hot. Two out of ten at the moment, my feeling.
Okay, I'm going to move. I'm going to go into my next move. Number two. Today, Sunday the 17th of January, is going to be the Democratic presidential... I can't speak. The Democratic presidential candidates debate taking place in Charleston, South Carolina. As I discussed with you, Rob, last week in the newspaper review, the competition's heating up.
Colonel Sanders. Mrs. Clinton.
Precisely. Bernie's pulling away. Well, not pulling away, but getting more popular. Last week, The Nation magazine endorsed him as the presidential nominee, just the third nominee they've endorsed since the magazine's been around.
Who are the other people? I only know those two.
I don't know. I don't think many other people have turned up into the other. Because they had that lectern, didn't they? They thought Biden was going to turn up to one of them, put an empty lectern there just in case he decided to get the last minute. Didn't show. That actually happened.
It's a bit embarrassing.
It is a little bit embarrassing. Yeah. So I think that's going to be an interesting one. The Nation has criticised Clinton's willingness to make deals, saying it's not going to bring the radical change the country needs. This is going to be another heated debate.
It's going to be one of big news of the coming week as well.
And there's going to be... Shall I move on? How are you feeling now?
I'm going to check in with you.
I'm hotting up.
You're heating up.
I kind of love... there's nothing I like more than a sort of an intra-German parliamentary discussion, especially about immigration. So a little
bird upstairs tipped me off to that before I came in, Rob. I'm not going to pretend otherwise.
Henry knows how to speak to men.
Yeah, I really do. I'm going to move... I mean, we're only halfway through, guys. Okay. So, you know... number three, on the same topic, US elections, but on this side of the pond, the House of Commons, on Monday the 18th, are going to debate the online petition that was signed by over 560,000 Brits demanding that billionaire businessman Donald Trump, billionaire businessman and potential Republican presidential nominee, should be banned from the UK.
That's tomorrow. I've been waiting for this discussion, actually. It's quite an interesting news story.
What are your thoughts and feelings?
Trump actually managed to get over 500,000 Brits to sign this petition to never let that guy into the country.
What do you feel about it?
I doubt it's going to happen. I think it's going to be quite a complicated one to actually say to a presidential candidate that you're not welcome to this country. It wouldn't be great for the future, and just in case Trump gets elected.
Well, we've kind of done it before.
God forbid, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be difficult for a diplomat. Well, presumably he would have diplomatic immunity at that point, right? But does the president have diplomatic immunity? I don't know.
I think if you own large parts of Scotland, you're probably allowed in.
Yeah. Even if it's on that golf course. Just on that golf course.
He's got to forever stay the night in the clubhouse. Okay.
Are you ready for the climax?
Yep.
On Sunday the 17th, the annual camel wrestling championship is set to take place in Seluk in Turkey. I've almost certainly pronounced that wrong. Sorry, Turkish people. Now, this is actually really genuinely quite sexy. Do you want to know the rules?
Yeah.
The event puts together two camels, the female camel, on heat nearby. The camels fight it out for the female, leaning on each other to push the other one down.
Well, this is good. This is a point of interest. We are kind of camel wrestling aficionados here on the Monocle Weekly because Tom Edwards, in his look ahead to the news of the year, mentioned this. And then one of our wonderful listeners wrote in to Andrew and I with some footage of a camel wrestling match.
Was it X-rated?
I don't know. I didn't get to the end.
Now, that's interesting.
I got to the sort of first leg.
It's genuinely interesting that you say that because there's a line in the report that I got this information from which reads as follows. It's one of my favourite lines I've read this week. The actual wrestling can be somewhat underwhelming to someone not familiar with the intricacies of the contest, although onlookers must often flee from an oncoming camel that is retreating in defeat from its opponent. If you were there, Rob... Perhaps the tension, the physical tension of those two beasts, you know, going toe to toe for a female on heat.
Cloven hoof to cloven hoof. Actually, they don't have cloven hoofs, do they? Camels.
I'm not sure if they do or not.
They've got a paddy sort of foot, haven't they?
Like a kind of elephantine kind of. Sure.
Just stop. The leg just stops and they're like, that'll do.
That'll do.
We don't need a foot.
Exactly. Yeah. We've got two humps.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the clothes.
So essentially, Henry, you should have warned us about this beforehand. It's a bit late now to try to head to Morocco to actually see that wrestling.
Well, listen, you were warned, as you said, early in the year by Tom Edwards. I think,
the
story should have been commissioned then. It's too late now. Maybe we can stream it somewhere. I don't know.
I wonder, I think there's probably a media story in this on whether or not it's on Turkish television.
Well, listen,
presumably it's a betting, it's a sport like cockfighting or indeed horse racing that's designed to be bet on, isn't it?
There's also an opening ceremony which must increase its televisual value.
Yeah.
The camels are decorated and participate in a march through the town, followed by musicians the day before the event.
Oh, that's so good.
It's an event made.
And whereabouts in Turkey is this?
It's in a place called Selçuk.
That's actually interesting. Turkey has come up with these amazing sports. I just actually mistakenly said it's in Morocco, but it's in Turkey. And I just remembered the one day a few years ago, I was in London. I ended up watching Turkish oil wrestling.
Oh, do you remember that? I'm familiar with this.
You had these guys over there basically wrestling, but they were covered in oil, and their job was to basically try to get a grip of each other's crotches and lift them in the air. And
then Marcus woke up and it was all a dream. Wet brackets. That's, I mean, oily.
Wow. No, that was
real, but it was still a memorable experience. I didn't see that coming when I walked into that park.
Hey,
I don't think there's any better,
guys.
I think there's any better way or place to end it.
Yeah.
Than there, Marcus. I don't think I want to do the rest of the show with you, Henry. Thank you.
You're a brilliant guy.
Thank you, for a fantastic, strange news look ahead.
Appreciate it.
We talk about books a lot on this show. We're a scholarly bunch, of course, and we like to learn things from those with a book or two in them. But what about those rethinking the role of the book itself? Is there anything more to be done with a design classic? Well, British novelist and London editor of the Paris Review, Adam Thirlwell, and visual artist Mary Ramsden think so. The two have collaborated on a new book project called Radio Paper.
It's a run of 30 visual books created by the two of them and available from London's Studio Lee Gallery. But this isn't any regular volume. It arrives framed in a fluorescent edged Perspex box and contains a series of abstract artworks by Ramsden and five specially written short tales by Thirlwell. And you won't find a linear logical page turner within. In fact, some of Adam's short stories are hidden among folds of the pages themselves. Adam, along with Studio Lee's Taya Lee Buzz, joined Rob a little earlier to try and explain what's going on.
Thanks for coming in. Adam, for handsomely bringing in, or not handsomely bringing in, but bringing in your handsome edition of Radio Paper.
Yes.
Complete in its Perspex box. It's such a fascinating project. I will start with you, actually, about how it came about to be writing these super short stories, collaborating with a visual artist. What was the conversation? Was it a drunk private view?
most things I do begin with a drunk private view. I'd met Mary a couple of years ago, I think, and normally I've kind of given a text, a kind of, you know, some kind of critical thing, but she came to me saying she had this idea for a kind of, she wanted to do, I think, her first artist book, and had this idea that it would come with sort of text by me. And what I found kind of interesting was she kind of came to me with a constraint. So she basically said that the whole kind of thing was going to be planned around this idea of the French fold, I think it's, you know, so that this idea where the page is uncut, so you can't actually, you know, you can kind of peek inside in some way, but what you can't see is the full page.
There's something tantalising about that.
Yeah, and so what I then kind of developed was this idea that it would be quite fun to do something similar with the text, so to play with almost the hinge, the kind of the fold, to do something where almost on a moment of suspense you'd write these short stories, and almost mimicking as well, I quite like, because she does these blocks, like the images are always in this kind of block of colour. And so I thought it'd be kind of interesting to do the same, where you'd get a block of text finishing in some cliffhangery way, some miniature cliffhangery way, and then you wouldn't be able to see in some way the finale. And then they became kind of these slightly dirty selfies, which was, I think it was partly because Mary had actually been, you know, we'd been talking about selfies a lot, and the way, you know, she's very interested, I think, in the way there can be a sort of similarity between the kind of way we're constantly swiping on phones and the kind of the similarity of that to the way an artist works. And also at the time I had been having to write a piece about Kim Kardashian selfies, so selfies were on my mind, and I just became quite interested in this idea of what a kind of self-portrait is, what you would want to disclose and what you can't, you know, what you can't help revealing. And so that was basically how I wrote the text.
So there's a lot of play both in your words and in Mary's piece of art, the book and the French Fold, that it's about, that's about being tantalizing, that's about sort of, and it's quite, it feels like a finished article, but also that it could be added to, or there's an element of the unfinished about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Mary beautiful keeps as it talking is. To me as if this could become a series, which is slightly terrifying that for the rest of my life I'm now
thinking of an ending
for Mary. But I think, yeah, I mean, I'm always envious in many ways of artists' practices. And one thing though that's interesting is if you do try and work together, they feel to me such different practices, you know, that language works in such a dismayingly concrete way often. And then when you get sort of an artist like Mary, who's, you know, explicitly an abstract artist, something almost quite old-fashioned in a way, even though I think there's something very kind of hyper-modern about the way she works. And the connection between abstract art and words has always been something that you have, you know, because you can't write about it. There's nothing, there's no about there. And so I was more interested almost in mimicking a kind of way she was working rather than I certainly didn't want it that there would be some, like, they'd be illustrations, you know, either one way around, either that she was somehow illustrating the words or I was illustrating.
And you don't want images. People to read it that way, that the art or the words come first. I suppose they have to be, you have to treat both those imposters just the same.
Yeah, although I suppose I do feel in a sense the art does come first. I feel slightly like this is, you know, it was an interesting thing to kind of be part of because, you know, that certainly the way, you know, the object, when you see the object, it feels so much more an art object than, you know, a paperback, as it were. And so very much I feel like, I don't mean it's more Mary's project, but, you know, in some way I think it was interesting kind of slipping inside another project, as it were, rather than just, it wasn't a total balance. It wasn't more.
Yeah, and there's something funny about the size and weight of that book and the amount of pages in it, and then how short your stories are as well. The fact that it is the most, it's a fantastically unwieldy short story book.
Yeah, and I think it's true that I'm rather pleased. Actually, I had a joke with this because when Mary was finishing, and I totally imagined that there were going to be about, I don't know, to me a book has to be a massive multiple. So I was imagining there'd be about 5,000 copies of this thing. Suddenly realising there's going to be like 30 and that they're huge. And sort of, and so that's also very interesting, I think, when you're working in kind of a visual medium, is I'm so used to such a standardised look. You know, the look to me of this book is so imposing. The combination of the Perspex cover, the kind of, the case, and then the size of the images, the size of the book, the weight of the paper. It's a completely, you know, it's still clearly a book, but it's a very different object to the kind you'd normally expect.
Yeah. Taya, it'd be great to bring you in here on this project. And is this part and parcel for Studio Lee? I mean, I know that your practice is kind of fusing the worlds of art and design, and your first show is getting artists to make useful things.
Yeah. So rather than sort of like pinpointing it as design, I mean, I kind of see it as the broad remit of a concept of use value, I suppose. I mean, that's quite a sweeping term. But from the first show, which was essentially 27 artists producing 25 works and was establishing how far the reach of that concept of use value and their conceptual practice was, you know, how far that can establish itself, or the breadth of that, I suppose, to then Mary, which really honed in on an element of kind of commonplace object and the book. I mean, going by what you've just said about it, sort of like having this essence of an artwork and it feeling like an artwork and the way that it hangs and the way that we read it.
How do you show this in the gallery?
So in the gallery, they're installed as sort of like a multiple. There's 20 of them all together on the wall, and they each of the Perspex cases have Some have a fluorescent strip and some are plain, and it kind of has this quite sort of like digital glow to it, which is, as you've said about Mary's sort of like use of the touch screen and the digital screen that we interact with. It has this real essence of that. So all together they are essentially like an installation of the works, and you see them as a painting. All the covers are hand painted. They're all unique. I think as we've started to build them, they've kind of almost built a typography in themselves. So when you sort of see them together, they become almost like her visual language, like produced by her painterly stroke. But what's quite beautiful about it is the way that they then hang, and then you can remove them from the wall and obviously take them from the case, and they become this page-turning, layering object that we then relate to a book. So for me, what was quite interesting, or when I first started talking to Mary about it, was finding this middle ground between how we can consider the book as functional object through its interactivity, essentially like how we physically are with a book and what that does to it visually, and then also having it, allowing it to become a, and stay as an art object.
Yeah, because there's something strange about an art book, even if it's a museum catalogue from a show you've seen. Mm. You take the catalogue home and you look at it, you love it for a week, don't you? You spend a lot of time with it, you sort of recreating your experience of walking around the gallery. But you necessarily have that a secondary appreciation of these things if you've seen them in the flesh, I suppose. And there's something strange about that. This book is an artwork in itself. It contains fresh stories and it kind of contains a fresh angle. So there's kind of a lot of playfulness with the idea of what a book is,
what it might be for. Yeah.
There's an interesting, your curator for this show, or there's a curatorial note on your on the Studio Lee website, which talks about this project, which is really interesting, which talks about the idea of appropriating nouns as verbs, like scroll and things, these old words about books and scrolls and parchment and all the rest of it, appropriating them for the modern world. And I suppose these pieces have that sense of them as well. There's old technology books, but they've got a Perspex cover. Quite sure what they're for.
Completely, but I think that's so intertwined with Mary's work in general, or the way that she approaches her painting. I mean, there is sort of like this starting point, she alludes to these sort of digital age technologies, but essentially sort of like her painterly craft. I mean, you know, it's a traditional medium to work in. So she really does bring these two sort of like very contemporary aesthetics with a traditional sort of like craft of her stroke.
Well, it's like the title. I remember we were talking about the title, and radio paper I love because it's the same thing as scrolling, where you have these two paper, like this ancient medium. Radio is not exactly kind of the most hypermodern. And that's the word used now for the kind of the way in which iPhone screens are made, you know, radio.
It's like a Kindle, isn't it? When you see a Kindle and it doesn't look like it looks like paper.
That's radio paper. So it's the technical term for something incredibly modern. And yet the words used are very old fashioned. So I think that's something fascinating about the whole project.
And I wanted to ask you, Adam, about the stories themselves, which are very short and sort of go in increasing levels of sort of sexiness and dirtiness as well. And I wonder whether you're writing explicitly about selfies. And I wonder whether the fact that writing about selfies in such a sort of big, permanent book, a book that's an art artifact as well, whether there's something there as well, that actually there's a comment about selfies being a lot more permanent than we might think, especially to the person that sent them.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about permanence. I think I was thinking about revelation, and certainly maybe also because it goes back to something I've always been interested in writing, is how much, you know, what you are revealing or not revealing when you write a novel. Because one of the kind of questions you become so bored of as a novelist is kind of to what degree your work is autobiographical, and kind of did this really happen to you? And what's always fascinating is, you know, that on the one hand, the correct aesthetic response is to say, you know, this question is utterly irrelevant. And at the same time, all novelists know that when they're in private, they're all gossiping about other novelists, saying, oh my God, I didn't know he was having an affair. You know, and so there's a sort of, but what's fascinating always is, it's so that, and both are true at once, that I think you do helplessly reveal yourself in a novel, not necessarily because literally those are kind of events have happened to you, but they show what you're preoccupied by.
It's sort of like the portrait artist sort of like always putting his face in the portrait.
And I think you can't help put your, you know, even if you don't want to, your face, if you write 200 pages of anything, you will reveal yourself in some way. And the selfie seemed to me kind of very similar but different, where it looks like the most revelatory kind of medium, that, you know, a naked selfie, as it were, when Kim Kardashian is kind of showing her bottom to kind of, and then there it is in a book. And yet actually nothing is that, you know nothing about this person. And I kind of found it also fascinating the way a selfie is both private and not private, that on the one hand, they can be sent just to one other person as a kind of special kind of gift, as it were. And yet also people are quite happy showing them to everyone. And so this kind of weird way in which the digital photo or something exists in sort of two places at once is weirdly similar to the way fiction also is both a very public medium and, you know, will encode highly private things. But the permanence is kind of,
I suppose you can whiz off a selfie to someone, but then in the hard drive of the receiver, and maybe in the memory as well, especially if it's a good one, it'll live forever.
And it's also true that you then don't own a selfie. A selfie you send, you then you no longer own it. That's the other thing. Then someone else owns it, and therefore, whether or not that's permanent really depends on them and not you. And I think there is an interesting analogy there with writing, that like there is always a way in which it's sent to the outside world, as it were, and like kind of how permanent it is will not depend on you.
Some thoughts for volume two.
Exactly, for the next in the series.
Adam said in an earlier answer that, you know, he was sort of a bit jealous of the visual artist's working practice, actually. And I wonder whether in your experience running the gallery, you see that the other way around as well, that a lot of visual artists might be jealous of a novelist, of someone that really probably won't leave the laptop alone until at least one page of white is turned black that day. and because it's about the rigor of the creative process as much as the kind of great light bulb moment as well. Do you hear that from some of the artists on your roster?
Have I heard that they've been jealous of a novelist?
Never.
Well, I mean,
no one's jealous of novelists.
Do you know what? They've never once said that. No. I don't think that's a direct conversation that I've ever had with any of them.
But I wonder whether the idea of the working practice, you know what I mean, is it's an interesting thing when you have a writer and a visual artist collaborating on a piece, what they both bring to it. I'm always intrigued when I go and do stories. The photographers that I work with always ask the best questions, and I always manage to tell them what to point the camera and take a picture of. Do you know what I mean? Because you both are trying to think for the other person.
Yeah, for sure.
So I suppose it's this.
I mean, the concept of collaboration throughout what Studio Lee's been doing has been very interesting because, I mean, there was a lot of talk from the first show, obviously, with there's been you and Mary collaborating, and you guys have had a lot of conversation back and forth about, even previous to Studio Lee, with the show she did with Pilar, too.
Yeah.
But this dialogue between, I mean, within the first show, a lot of the artists ended up making or working in ways that they hadn't necessarily worked before, or with materials or routes in which they hadn't taken. So what I started doing was, I suppose, finding a route for them to do that. So that began a lot of dialogue with fabricators, technicians, manufacturing routes, I suppose, which almost became collaborative in a way. I mean, it was collaborative to be able to produce the work, I suppose. And that always created really interesting conversation between practices, because you've got, on the one hand, the sort of like very developing creative mind and the artist who's sort of like striving to bring to fruition their conceptual idea, I suppose. And then you've got this like really technical sort of like, you know, you can't do that, you've got to put that here, blah, blah, blah. And those conversations were really interesting. But I think perhaps with going into novels or literature, I mean, the idea of narrative and moving through narrative from a writer's perspective, I mean, there's got to be, there are for sure a lot of like links intrinsically with that, and the almost the building of a story of a piece of artwork as well, where you begin, where you end with it. I mean, there's structure, there's, I mean, visual linguistics that, I mean, are completely related, I would say. So I think creative process is creative process. I think, I mean, it's unique to everybody. I mean, everyone has their own way, but I think the structure of it, or where you start and then where you end up, there's you know, there's all the arguments and the fights and the stamping of feet that I'm sure you go through as well, Adam.
You do know a lot about this gruesome twosome. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you for talking us through Radio Paper, Adam Thirlwell and Taya Lee Bars. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank pleasure. You. Thank you very much.
Time for some new music now. This week, the world bid an abrupt farewell to a true icon of popular culture, David Bowie. We'll be hearing a chat with Bowie's one-time personal photographer, Mick Rock, at the end of the show this week. But first, let's hear the final song of Bowie's final album, Black Star, released just a week ago. This is I Can't Give Everything Away.
Seeing more and feeling less, saying no but meaning yes. This is all I ever meant. That's the message that I sent. I can't give everything.
That was David Bowie with I Can't Give Everything Away. Stay tuned for a chat about David at the end of the show. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We'll be listening back to a recent interview about the work of David Bowie a little later from someone who knew him best, his personal photographer, Mick Rock. But before that, let's look to something happening now and in music's future. We're joined now on the line from New York by composers and theatre producers Ella Spira and Pietra Mello Pittman, better known as the Sisters Grimm.
The duo's collaboration with South African band Ladysmith Black Mambazo and choreographer Mark Baldwin has led to Inala, a so-called Zulu ballet, which has been a critical success in theatres over the past year or so. Now Inala's soundtrack has been nominated for a Grammy. Ella and Pietra will soon be focusing on the music of Brazil for a new production, but they join us now to tell us how their eye for global musical styles feeds into theatrical box office success. Ella and Pietra, aka Sisters Grimm, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Shall we start with a bit of background? Could you start by telling us how the idea for Inala was born?
I'm Pietra, and I was a ballet dancer in the Royal Ballet for 13 years, and Ella, my business partner, took me to a concert of Ladysmith Black Mambazos. They're obviously very famous, and she'd wanted to work with them for a long time. It was her ambition. And we just, they obviously sounded incredible, but we both knew we had this vision, an idea of what we could do with collaboration and visual performance, the sort of skills that I come from, choreography.
So we also looked into all of this area that we felt that they hadn't really ventured into before, and set about kind of laying the groundwork for doing something that was really new and interesting. And we met up with them and they were really excited. And so we went out to South Africa and worked with them in 2010. So it was a 5-year project till it opened in 2014 in Edinburgh. So we opened the Edinburgh International Festival and then did Sadler's Wells in London and a regional tour, and was even on the Royal Variety performance that year, which was lovely.
and you obviously, I mean, with a musical like this, and presumably we mentioned your upcoming Brazilian thing as well, you're looking for a story as well. Are you looking for music that sort of lends itself to any story, or did Inala sort of have a very obvious sort of plot line that would have run through it by the subject of the band's songs, for example?
No, and all of the music was completely original. So they and I co-wrote together, and it was the first time they'd written with the piano, and it was the first time they'd co-written with a woman, which was, you know, a massive honour for me to have done that with them for the first time. The songs were all written around a rough storyline that Pietra and I had developed and put together. In the end, the piece is quite abstract. The storyline is definitely there, and you can feel it, but it is a bit more kind of scenes of South African life, really. But that is internationally relevant, so people from, you know, all across the world relate to it, which is why we've managed to have such a broad appeal with it, really.
I was just going to ask about that. Obviously, as you mentioned, it did have a broad appeal in all. Also considering that the soundtrack has been nominated for a Grammy, what else? How did you achieve that broad appeal?
It's so entertaining and feel good. There are some very emotional songs in there. One of the first songs, the first song that Ella wrote with Mambazo, was called Usizi, and the themes of that are about keeping your goals and your focus and not giving up. And the way that Ella has woven in Western percussion makes the songs quite pop-like, and makes for really, you know, appeal across a broad range of ages. And visually on stage, Mambazo have a quite big, the eldest member is
68,
and we also had the youngest performer was a boy from Rombert Dance School called Jacob O'Connell that won BBC's Young Contemporary Dancer. And so huge age range on stage.
He's appealing. 17.
He's 17. Didn't actually say how old he was. 17. Youngest member, so 17.
Said he was 63.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And so it just appealed to a wide audience, drum beats, pop almost pop song. So it was this mix between, you know, a ballet, a concert, and then a theatrical performance. So it did, we brought together, and all the stats prove that we did bring together all these different audiences and attracted new audience members as well.
And Ella, I wanted to ask you specifically actually about the composition of this and talking about the fact that, you know, it's got a very pop sensibility to it. Reading your biography on the Sisters Grimm website makes quite interesting reading, because you kind of wear your learning very lightly, actually. You talk about, you know, having a career in the entertainment industry, and that's, you use that phrase rather than in the arts or in kind of in drama and all the rest of it. Is that how very much how you see it, to bring, you know, voices like Ladysmith Black Mambazo that are pop voices but pop in another sort of environment, to bring them to sort of international ears?
That's exactly what it is. And I suppose I didn't go to university, but I had training in all of the different areas of things that I needed and wanted training in. So I had private tuition in lots of stuff, orchestration. I did a conducting course for 2 years that was sort of every weekend in front of a full orchestra. I have played the piano since I was 6, but I've always been obsessed with Disney films. And then when I was 17, I left school and joined the BBC, and worked at the BBC for a bit whilst I was writing music for kind of quirky, arty little things. But sort of from 14, I always wanted to be a Disney music composer. I was like, you know, Disney animations, that's where I'm going, that's where I'm at. And I think I've got that sensibility to the way that I write music. And then from the BBC, I then went and worked at Ministry of Sound. So I then have kind of worked in that dance music area. And I think I've got I would say that I'm not an expert in anything, but I know bits about quite a lot of things. And I think, you know, I'm really interested in how you can maximise all of that and bring people together and make something accessible to different people and make it fun and make it nice to listen to that makes you feel good.
Well, you are focusing on a new production at the same time as well. The audience will hear music of Brazil over there. How much more can you tell us? What's coming up?
Well, we have a premiere for this new production in 2017. It's a Brazilian-UK production, as you say. I'm half Brazilian. I was born in Brazil with a Brazilian mother, an English father, and I was brought up in England, so it's sort of an exploration. And again, there'll be artists from Brazil and the UK, and Ella will once again work with an artist from Brazil, a pop lyricist. So it'll be a fusion. And we'll take elements of the Brazilian visual culture and weave it into our narrative. This one will have a very strong narrative visually.
Pietra, just to carry on that, talking about getting this new stuff, you know, we've talked about Enala, we're talking about your Brazilian project. How easy is it to get new stuff made? I mean, obviously, as a ballerina, you danced the classics and you did dance them all. How easy is it, you know, that's not a backward-looking industry by any means, but it's got a canon of classics that everybody wants to see. It must be nice working on new stuff, but how easy is it to get made?
It is. Well, it's now we have a bit of a name. We've got, you know, Grammy nomination behind us. You still have to work incredibly hard. Enala was, as Ella mentioned, we conceived the idea in 2009 and opened in 2014. So now our next production is not going to take as long at all, and we have a date for its premiere in 2017. So
deadlines, call them deadlines.
Exactly. We've got our trips to Brazil planned over the next year and a half until we open, to make that fusion, authentic fusion, which is really important for us to go to Brazil. Ella wrote the music for Enala in South Africa with Mambazo. So it's difficult. It comes with its challenges, of course. International collaborations do.
What kind of challenges are there?
I suppose there are. So, what's the first one? I think it's a funny one, because I think with Enala, you sort of preempt that there's going to be challenges, and then ultimately music is an international language. So even though Mambazo don't read a score, and they don't, you know, if I said a chord or if I said a load of notes to them, they wouldn't know what I was talking about. But we found this language and this way of communicating together immediately. But I think, you know, I'd really done my homework. If I had turned up and not prepped and not sort of thought about things that might come up, I think that it could have, that thing of finding a language for communicating between two people could have been quite challenging and quite difficult, but it's about finding the strengths and preparing and thinking about those strengths beforehand. The one of the things that I think is quite interesting is that people can be quite risk adverse. So sometimes when you talk about an idea to people that is new, that is approaching something in a completely different way, people's immediate reaction, especially in this sort of, you know, time of austerity or whatever, people can kind of go, oh, is that a good idea? Is that going to work? Is it actually going to work in bringing two things together? But if it's approached in the right way, it really can. And those people, you know, some of the people we worked with actually were not sure whether it was going to be a success bringing the two things together, two separate things together for Inala, but it soon proved that it did, and that makes people feel more confident and it pushes art forms forward. And it makes, you know, sometimes things are used to help international diplomatic relations, and that whole area of it is really interesting as well.
And talking about risk adversity, I know that you guys do work with companies as well. I mean, you put on these fantastic shows, but you do kind of consultancy work. You know, presumably you get people that in businesses that maybe are risk averse, or, you know, and you give them some help with sort of theatrical leaning solutions to that. How does that work? How, I mean, how different also is that to getting a musical off the ground?
It's, to us, it's storytelling. It's getting somebody's message across, because sort of we're sort of the audio-visual experts, really. But in both our, you know, lives, it's about emotions and how you want the audience, in our case, or the people you're reaching out to feel, and what you want them to understand about your project, your brand, your company. So for us, you know, it's storytelling. It's not really different, is it?
I think the other thing is that some people like dealing with us because we're very honest and we're very upfront about things. And you can, I think, you know, you can talk about things about art and you can address some problems, and you can not skim over the fact that there are issues with lots of different things. And they can be talked about and they can be addressed. And I think that is one of the things that people like with us as well. And we're certainly about a million miles away from being precious. So, you know, that whole honesty thing and going, well, yeah, we will manage, look at what their corporate thing is and make sure that we're in line with that.
Just a minute ago, you said what I found interesting is that these kind of musical collaborations have been used for international diplomacy. Can you specify what your input has been in terms of, I don't know, improving British South African relations, for example?
The collaboration itself was groundbreaking across several different areas, but it marked 20 years of democracy when we opened, and it wasn't retrospective, it was about looking forwards, giving a positive image about where we are right now. And it was a beautiful, sort of honest, authentic collaboration, and that I think a lot of people were very moved by the production.
It also, yeah, I mean, the other thing is, when we first went out to South Africa, South Africa were kind of having a bit of a tough time. They were being given a lot of bad press about how, you know, in inverted commas, how dangerous it is. There was that thing with that poor woman who was there on her honeymoon and had been killed. And we went there anyway, and we were supported by the South African Tourism Board, I think, you know, possibly in part because they were struggling a bit, and we were saying, well, we're still going, we're going to go. So they supported us. And I think for us to have, we filmed everything, so we filmed us out there. And then for us to be portraying South Africa in the way that we were, so many people said to us that were our audience members that, you know, South Africa hadn't exactly been top of their list of places to go to, but that we had evoked the feeling of South Africa to them and that it made them want to go. So from that point of view, I think that is where we achieved a development. And the fact that also, you know, Mambazo hadn't broken this ground of having their music notated, they hadn't worked with a woman, they hadn't worked with the piano, and, you know, we did all this stuff, and now it's been recognised internationally and by kind of the International Music Awards. I think that's quite a big step forward, really.
It's good stuff. It's a great story, beautifully told. Pietra and Ella, congratulations on the Grammy nomination, and thank you very much for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much
for having us.
The legendary British musician David Bowie died on Monday, aged 69. The master of provocative pop and countless reinventions had been battling cancer for the past 18 months, but hadn't made that battle public. His death came as a surprise to all but his inner circle. There's been no shortage of commentary and dedications to the singer, of course, but we thought we'd end the show this week by listening back to a recent interview we did on the Monocle Weekly with Bowie's personal photographer, Mick Rock, who helped create the iconic images that saw the pop star shoot to fame in the 1970s. Mick also defined the images of Bowie's contemporaries Lou Reed and Iggy Pop, with his photography adorning classic albums such as Transformer and Raw Power, amongst others.
Let's join Rob's chat with Mick, with the photographer, explaining just what it was about Bowie that first caught his eye, that otherworldly quality that we won't see the likes of again.
He had a grace to him. I think that was something that struck me. He was a very... He had a refinement about him from the beginning, even in the smaller gigs, that I hadn't really seen before. So he was always working on a different level to your average, well, average might be the wrong word, in the but whoever it was.
What was some of the flip side of that, Mick? I mean, you know, you mentioned Lou Reed and Iggy Pop. They came from the New York Underground, which was the kind of, you know, sort of ground zero for everything that was cool. What was it like hanging out with those?
They both came to England to clean up, as well as to make the records that David really hustled for them. And of course, I mean, I saw a lot of the dark side in those two, but I never really saw a dark side in David. He was more like a... In many ways, that summer, it was more like a ringmaster. You got to remember, I think almost the first cat out of the bag was Mott the Hoople's All the Young Dudes. And certainly that album was released before Ziggy Stardust. So something happened right in front of my eyes that he was, well, he believed in his destiny. You got to listen to the Ziggy Stardust album and imagine a time when nobody's heard it. And when he is not a star, and what is he doing? He's projecting throughout that. And I did interviews with him in those early days, and he, it's 1972, you know, to talk about how ambitious you were was unusual, because it's still, you know, you got a bunch of hippies still hanging around. He must have had some kind of Sartori, which I think he did, and I think it was Buddhist related, where he saw his destiny and he grasped it and he projected and he developed it. And he was adding things, layers and clothes. And I shot him in that 20-month period in 74 different outfits.
I wanted to ask you about one specific picture, Mick, which is kind of, well, it's not an accidental part of this book at all, but obviously there are so many performance shots and there are so many on and off stage ones. But this is the British Rail lunch shot.
Yes,
with David and Mick. That, now, that's an amazing shot. And I love the fact that it's in this book, which is full of such artistry and also the kind of the other side of it, the kind of Brechtian side of seeing someone getting changed, putting their makeup, all the rest of it. There is nothing more ordinary than a British Rail lunch. It is amazing to see two men that look like Martians eating boiled cabbage with a knife and fork.
And the look that's going on between them, like they know they've got something by the tail. Remember, this is the beginning. They're on the way to Aberdeen, no less, the beginning of that last tour. Not that he was telling anybody that at the time. And they've got something serious going on, and they know it. And of course, Mick was the main person to help him develop that, certainly from the musical point of view. And of course, he looked fabulous. I mean, never in the history of rock and roll was there such a, well, such a beautiful combo. Let's put it like that. There have been many great combos, but nobody ever looked like those two, either on stage or off stage. Yes, people like that shot.
And tell me about the Lou Reed one. Lou Reed's well known in journalism circles as quite a tough cookie to interview. Was he a darling to shoot?
Oh, he was a sweetie. But he was my friend. I mean, I had barely met him when I shot the Transformer cover. But we remained friends, and I shot him throughout the 70s consistently. Yeah. Lou and David, from the beginning, even when neither of them were so well known, I saw as two sides of the same coin. On the bright, obviously, and colourful side, you had London and David Bowie. On the dark, dark subterranean side, you had Lou Reed in New York. So they had a certain bond built on the fact that David and Mick co-produced Transformer. And of course, to this day, I believe it's still his biggest selling album. And it certainly was his breakout record and that finally put him on the map. I mean, in a certain sense, you might argue that David helped make him the star that he became. Albeit, of course, a complicated one. And certainly, yep, I've sat there and seen him torture a journalist or two. I remember one guy, he tortured this guy who seemed not to know quite enough about Lou, which always irritated Lou. He thought they needed to be properly prepared if he was going to put out his time for them. And he, as the guy left the room, he turned round to me and gave me a big wink. So he was, you know, he would deliberately do that. David, on the other hand, was always charming and gave great interviews. I'm sure most journalists are very sad that he hasn't talked to the press in about a decade. But on the other hand, can you imagine in this day and age, if David were up for giving interviews, he could be sitting there doing interviews 24 hours a day because there are so many outlets that need material.
And just finally, Mick, I mean, we're talking about a very specific era of one artist that you've worked with. There's been a huge history of almost a history of rock and roll and punk and all sorts of other types of music, new wave and all the rest of it, and going right up till now. Do you want to shoot people that exude stardom, or do you think that you can kind of get something out of someone as a photographer yourself? I mean, are there people that you think, whoa, you scratch your head and you think, this ain't no Bowie?
I don't think like that. If I'm going to do a session for whatever reason, for money or because I want to, I love them all going in. Doesn't matter who they are. Doesn't matter how difficult people say they are. It doesn't really... I mean, maybe because I've done so much yoga over the years and really I haven't done a session, other than the early Syd Barrett ones, without having done some yoga beforehand. Even in my 20 serious chemical years, I still did yoga before a shoot. Even if I hadn't slept, I would, well, because in the days I hung out with Lou, he didn't allow his friends to sleep. But that's a whole other tale. I just follow what I was interested in. The other thing you've got to remember is the state of housing. In the 70s, you could live very cheap in London and New York and probably in most other big cities in the world. I don't know how young artists do it today because real estate is ridiculous in London and New York nowadays. So that whole bohemian era, well, it doesn't really exist anymore. You know, the fact that you weren't thinking about money, you could survive on not very much. I think that was helpful in many ways because your brain was freed up just to get on with the creative factor. And looking back, one thing I do note, besides all the visuals and the costumes and all the lunacy that went on, the music stands up. So what can I tell you? We could go on for days about this. But
no, Mick, it's been fantastic. It's been an honour speaking to you as well. The book is absolutely beautiful and it's just such a wealth of amazing imagery and it captures, 2 years? I mean, it's quite fantastic stuff. So Mick Rock, thank you very much for your time.
All right, love. You have a good one.
Mick Rock there discussing the formative years of a cultural icon, David Bowie, who died this week.
And there we have it, Marcus. That's the end of edition 341 of the Monocle Weekly.
That was a lot of fun. Thank
you. It was a good one. It was ended slightly sorrowfully there. With nice to hear from Mick Rock again. What a legend he is as well. But a bit of a funny old week, really. I don't quite know. We've obviously done covered Bowie quite a lot on Monocle 24, as has every other news outlet in the world. But it's a bit of a strange one. I think maybe we can play some Bowie over the end of this show. Who knows?
I think we should.
And nice to install some future cultural collaborators as well. The Sisters Grimm were quite good fun, weren't they?
They were. I'm quite looking forward to that new Brazil project they have over there.
Yeah. What, are you looking for a little? What, are you looking for a little press trip out there? You were chatting them up
that
on the telephone, weren't you?
I was. Yeah. It was really funny actually. I was speaking to them beforehand, and they were quite giggly.
They were quite giggly. I think that's because they knew you brought your Havaianas to the studio in preparation for the chat. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Marco Sippi.
Thanks for tuning in.
It's goodbye.